We have talked about it endlessly over the last decade or so, and we've accomplished close to zip.
We know enough about our climate problem to know that it's serious and that we need to get started right away.
What we're seeing right now is a clear loading of the weather dice.
A plan to improve the walleye population of Lake Mille Lacs stunned many business owners today.
The Minnesota DNR announced anglers won't be allowed to keep any walleye they catch on Mille Lacs this season, and they can't use any live bait. That's never been done, but the DNR says it's necessary to grow a dwindling walleye population.
That's how WCCO-TV describes the unprecedented news on Lake Mille Lacs this week, where plunging walleye population is causing some big changes. On ClimateCast today, is climate change one of the factors affecting walleye in Mille Lacs and fishing across Minnesota? Welcome back, everybody. I'm NPR News Chief Meteorologist Paul Huttner. Let's be clear up front. Fisheries scientists say there are many factors that may be affecting the walleye population in lakes like Mille Lacs. Overfishing, invasive species like zebra mussels, even increased predators on young walleyes, they may all be playing a role. But from a climate standpoint, one thing is increasingly clear. Big, shallow lakes like Mille Lacs are a special laboratory for Minnesota's warming climate. They can be more sensitive to temperature changes than the deeper lakes, and there's now some evidence that some fish that are critical food for the walleye, like the cisco, are very sensitive to these warmer summer temperatures. So how is climate change a factor in the walleye population on Mille Lacs, or is it? What do we know? What don't we know yet about how climate shifts in Minnesota will affect our fish populations? And I want to hear your thoughts on this, because I know this is a hot-button topic for Minnesota. So if you want to weigh in on your perspectives and what you see happening, your observations, what changes you're seeing at your favorite Minnesota lake as our climate warms, pick up the phone now and give me a call. 651-227-6000 is the number to call in the Metro, 800-242-2828 in Greater Minnesota. Two great guests today to cast a line into these waters, so to speak. Peter Jacobson is a Habitat Group Supervisor for Minnesota DNR Fisheries Research, and John Lencheski is the Executive Director for Minnesota Trout Unlimited. Peter, let's start with you, and I want to dig right into this question of walleye and Mille Lacs first. There's a lot we still don't know, I know that, but you and I were talking the other day. There is evidence that warmer lake temperatures are affecting the cisco population. That's an important food source for walleye, right?
Yeah, exactly. They're a real high-energy, high-fatty fish that produce some of the largest walleyes in the state and really give us the good growth rates on those large walleyes.
And there's plenty of small walleye in Mille Lacs, right? Does the science you're looking at yet pinpoint a cause for why they're not growing up to be keepers?
Yeah, there is. And there's actually some good news on that front. You know, as you mentioned, there's a lot of different factors that are affecting that decline of walleyes in that population. But according to some real recent calculations that we've done, it might not be climate that is affecting the walleyes directly. We certainly feel that the cisco decline in Mille Lacs and a number of lakes around the state are due to climate, but we were able to apply some Mille Lacs Lake temperature models to, or Mille Lacs Lake temperatures to, a new model from Wisconsin that shows us that we're still likely on the cool side of that curve, and so conditions are still good for walleyes, walleye reproduction, and for the walleye population itself in Mille Lacs.
So sanity check this for me, because I'm not a fisheries guy, obviously, but I am a scientist who looks at a lot of variables every day and evaluates which ones are most important to predicting an outcome. So as sort of a layman scientist, if I look at climate change and warming lakes like Mille Lacs, the thinning cisco population, that's a major food source for walleye and other fish. And then you learn that young walleye may be replacing cisco maybe as a food source for other fish that used to eat cisco. It seems to me like common sense that climate change might be at least an indirect effect on that walleye population. Is that a possibility, and we just don't have the hard data yet?
Well, it certainly is, and we do know that cisco can affect the walleyes, primarily through growth rates. If there's shifts in how they feed on other fish, if they don't have cisco, that certainly is a much more complicated question. But the good thing that Mille Lacs and a lot of lakes like it have going for it is we still have good yellow perch populations. And yellow perch can be an excellent forage fish, especially for the smaller, medium-sized walleyes. So from that point of view, that's also good news. So even as we lose our ciscos, as long as we still have yellow perch in this system, we'll still have good forage for walleyes at a small and medium size. It's really the larger walleyes that take the biggest hits if we lose cisco.
John, you're a trout guy. What about our rivers? Are you noticing changes in our rivers as climate shifts in Minnesota?
Well, yes, we absolutely are. It certainly affects our habitat work, but from a fisherman's perspective, sportsmen and women who are members, we do see the changes as far as timing of fishing runs, say the steelhead season, that is shifting drastically. And we're also observing it with, aquatic insect hatches that the members who fly fish key in on. But, the broader concern is with that early steelhead season is what we are left with is a longer period of low, warm summer flows. And that is having an impact on brook trout and steelhead on the North Shore.
Well, and let's talk about those flows for a minute, because here's one thing we're observing. We know this is not a model. This is an observation. And, of course, river systems are more sensitive to the increased amplification in rainfall in Minnesota that we're seeing. The data shows it's raining perhaps less frequently, but it's raining harder. So how does that affect trout streams if we're seeing higher variability throughout the season?
Well, it's actually been pretty, recent events have been pretty devastating. The June 2012 floods in northeastern Minnesota, a good example of one of those unprecedented, severe rainfall events. The flooding from that just absolutely destroyed habitat in dozens of key rivers and left very unstable channels. So, the fish habitat has been destroyed, and our habitat projects we're adapting to that and trying to plan for those kind of big events in the future. We need to, what used to be maybe improving some habitat in an otherwise stable channel, our projects now are more focused on making sure we recreate a stable channel to handle those bigger flows that we're seeing and still leave good habitat. So in our design of projects, we now require the consultants we use, they're looking at NOAA's, projections for, the Atlas 14, and I'm not an expert at that, but essentially requiring, we're looking at those projections for the type of intense storms in the future and designing our projects accordingly. But they're much, bigger scale projects than there used to be. And that's one aspect. But there's other aspects, implications for our work, especially in northern Minnesota with forest planning and what, climate is doing to mm-hmm. our forests and how do we ensure we have tree canopy and healthy forests to act as essentially sponges that take in water and release it slowly over the course of the year. So we're having to adapt where it's really, we're seeing the impacts in our habitat work and watershed work.
You're listening to ClimateCast on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm NPR Chief Meteorologist Paul Huttner. We're talking about climate change and fishing in Minnesota, and I'd love to hear your comment or question if you want. We've got Peter Jacobson with the Minnesota DNR and John Lacheski with Minnesota Trout Unlimited. 651-227-6000, that's the number to call in the Twin Cities. Toll-free 800-242-2828, or you can jump online at nprnews.org/live. Refuge lakes, that's a concept I'm hearing about, Peter. Why are some lakes a safer harbor for some fish in Minnesota as our climate warms up?
Yeah, it's actually a bright spot, in the midst of a lot of the gloom and doom that seems to happen with climate discussions mm-hmm. and effects on our natural resources. But it turns out, of the 650 cisco lakes we have in the state, there's about 175 of them that are deep enough and clear enough that even after significant climate warming in the state, they're still going to provide good cold water habitat for fish like cisco. So we identified those lakes in conjunction with some modeling that we did with our colleagues at the University of Minnesota, and now looking at implementing some pretty significant conservation on those lakes. It's what the key thing is to protect those lakes and protect that cold water habitat is to protect the water quality in those lakes. the reason they have good oxygen way down deep for those cold water fish to survive is because they have excellent water quality, and that is the focus of our conservation efforts.
Here's something I'm curious about, Peter, because we know the zebra mussels are here, other invasive species. I live close to Lake Minnetonka, and I know the water clarity has improved dramatically because these things are filter feeders and they suck out a lot of the algae that kind of clouds up the water. How are zebra mussels factoring into the fishing equation? Does clearer water make it easier to catch fish or easier for some fish to prey perhaps on young walleye? What do we know about that?
Yeah, the clear water, the shifts from clear water are significant, and each fish has a optimal range in terms of how clear the water needs to be. And as you change that water clarity, it's going to change the kind of fish that are favored. As in any of these systems, there's winners and losers. And as you clear the water, you're going to favor species that feed visually, that need vegetation, for example, to hide in, versus a more turbid situation where fish are feeding by smell and lateral line. And that can change things, absolutely.
Yeah, that's amazing what happens below the surface. It's a jungle down there. John, that refuge lake strategy, can that apply to rivers? Can there be refuge rivers?
Absolutely. And in fact, at least along the North Shore, we've already been taking that approach, working with the DNR and many other partners to identify what we're calling the top-tier watersheds there, approximately 20 watersheds in the Lake Superior Basin that are currently the best fisheries, and we think have the greatest potential to maintain a cold water fishery in the future. So in conjunction with that, we're working with NRRI up at UMD and the University of Minnesota to try and identify those cold water areas in these top-tier watersheds so that we can protect the recharge areas. And then we're also going to be focusing our work there, and hopefully of all our partners, in just those watersheds. It's kind of like, you know, focusing on those refuge lakes. We're going to have some refuge watersheds so that we ensure we have some good cold water fishing in the future. So we take a similar kind of approach as Pete was mentioning. It's about protecting the areas that need to be protected, reconnecting the habitat. Sometimes we have culverts that block the fish movement. They move to get to cold water, and then restoring habitat. So it is important to be strategic in our work. And so we're same kind of thing. We're focused on those refuge watersheds, if you will, and very supportive of the DNR's work and Pete's work on those refuge lakes, because many of those are native lake trout lakes. So we're very supportive of that work, very thrilled that the DNR is focusing on those, because we want that sort of cold water angling available for our children and grandchildren, well into the future.
Yeah, and you know, I think that's an important point. We need to honor the discussion for everybody in Minnesota. Look, I'm an angler. I enjoy getting out there. I'm not a pro by any means. But there's resort owners, there's bait shop owners. You know, fishing industry and tourism is huge in Minnesota. So this, I think, is very important discussion going forward and to look at the science of this. Bill in River Falls is on the line. Bill, good morning. What's your question?
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I'm not a huge fisherman, but I do fish, and I do fish walleye. I've done it several times in Canada, Manitoba. And my general question about these trends in weather and climate being much bigger than the local weather, are you seeing the same sort of trends of depletion of feedstock fish that might impact walleye population, say, in Manitoba or in northern Wisconsin or, you know, in Montana or wherever you might else follow fish populations? Or, you know, because the climate obviously is going to not respect borders.
Right.
And it's going to impact the broader region. So any comments on coordination of the data from a broader region to establish some of these correlations?
Bill, great question. Peter, do you talk to your counterparts, I suppose, in other states? What are you hearing?
Yeah, absolutely. Great question. We do, and we collaborate very closely. And the story is very interesting. The Cisco, which I do most of my research on, is widely spread across the northern part of the continent. At the very southern part of the range, in Indiana, Southern Michigan, Southern Wisconsin, they're seeing very sharp declines. In fact, they've lost Cisco in nearly all of the Indiana lakes where they existed, many of the southern Wisconsin lakes into central and northern Wisconsin, probably more than Minnesota has, and then into central and northern Minnesota. We don't know about Ontario. They're probably in a little better shape because they are further north, but there definitely seems to be a northward migration of this problem.
Interesting stuff, and a little scary too, I think. You know, guys, we've got about a minute left here. As we look forward to some of these changes that we're seeing, and as we hear they're kind of making their way north into Minnesota as the climate shifts, fishing is a big industry here. How do we look at the economic impacts of climate change and fishing going forward? What's your sense of what we might project for the next 50 years? John, your thoughts on that?
Well, it is. It's huge business. I think it's about $4.7 billion last I heard statewide. In the Southeast, I think we're in a little better shape. It's a huge part of that economy, but we have more groundwater there, so I think we're in good shape there. My concern would be the rest of the state, and it will have an impact. But it is a big driver.
Peter, what do you think?
Huge industry. It's going to remain a huge industry. There will be a shift in the kinds of species we see in our lakes, but I think the critical thing that we're learning that is if we can keep these lakes in good shape, and that means in good water quality condition, they may see a shift in some of the species, but they'll still be high-quality species assemblages that'll still provide excellent fishing. So I think even with climate warming, there's still going to be very good fishing opportunities in Minnesota.
Guys, I got to tell you, I thought this would be a good discussion today, but I'm blown away by the quality of the content that you guys brought today. Peter Jacobson with Minnesota DNR Fisheries, John Lencheski from Minnesota Trout Unlimited. Thanks so much for your insight, guys.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Finally, this hour, a climate story that caught my eye and ear earlier this week on All Things Considered. It's about climate and wine. Of course, winemakers were tracking changes in the climate long before us meteorologists existed. They kept records of things like harvest dates, and researchers have been going through these past records. A new paper this week in the journal Nature Climate Change, the researchers report on how those records give an insight into what's happening now as the globe heats up. Here's NPR's Allison Aubrey with the story.
Wine grapes are pretty sensitive to temperature and drought, and during hot years, winemakers tend to harvest their grapes earlier. Elizabeth Wolkovich, who runs an ecology lab at Harvard University's Arnold Arboretum, thought early records of harvests could be useful.
I think grapes are a great window into changes in climate. My colleague Benjamin Cook of NASA and I were interested in using long-term harvest dates of wine grapes to see how climate had changed and even to try to reconstruct climate.
Wolkovich says the farther you go back in time, the less information we have about climate.
We often don't have the really long-term records that we want to be able to say, were things happening in the 1700s and 1800s the same as what's been happening in the 1900s and onward?
But with grapes in France, Wolkovich's colleagues found records going back to the 1300s. Monasteries weren't just for prayer and contemplation. Monks tended large vineyards and kept meticulous records. Wolkovich's colleague, Anaki Garcia de Cortazar Atuari, tracked down these records.
Anaki went to the old libraries in Avignon and pulled down the books that were kept by different sort of church properties. And these handwritten records were carefully compiled from all across France.
When they put all of this data together, they saw a pattern in Western Europe that remained stable for centuries. It took a heat wave and a drought in the same year to drive temperatures high enough to lead to an early harvest. But beginning in the 1980s, this pattern started to break down. Rising temperatures alone started to move the harvest forward, and this trend has accelerated.
So if you think about places in the south of France where they're tending to harvest usually in late September, early October, they're shifting earlier across France about 2 weeks. So a really big change in when we harvest wine grapes.
Now, if you're a wine lover, this is not necessarily a bad thing, at least in the short term.
Hotter summers are usually higher quality wines in France, and so we do actually have higher quality wines on average with climate change. The issue is we can't keep warming up the system and expect that to continue.
And it's not just in Western Europe that weather conditions are forcing winemakers to think about how to adapt to the changes. Lee Hanna is an ecologist with Conservation International. He says vintners around the globe are buying up land and places that used to be considered too cool for wine growing.
Places like Tasmania, even in Montana, where people are starting to grow wine grapes. And the crop model suggests that those areas will become really good for growing wine.
But don't expect a lot of Montana Merlot. Vintners there are experimenting with hybrid grapes that are more suited to their climate. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
Here's what I'm watching this week in climate news. A new survey from Ed Maybach, he's been on ClimateCast before, at George Mason University, released this week, shows that more of my American Meteorological Society member peers now recognize human-caused climate change than ever before. 96% think climate change is happening, a large majority think that human activity is causing it, and nearly one in five AMS members say their opinion of climate change has changed in the past 5 years. Increasingly, it looks like meteorologists are listening to the science on climate change. That's another ClimateCast this week. Thanks for listening, everybody. And remember, though, even though you can't see the world's weather out your front window, we can talk about it here.